I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who has left a podcast review so far. It's been fantastic to see what you guys are making of the podcast and really enjoy reading them. Rest assured, I do read every single one. So thanks again. And if you haven't left a review yet, it would do us a massive favor if you would, as that would help us grow this community and reach more grassroots coaches who will benefit from these conversations. So thanks again, and we really appreciate it. Welcome to the Athletic Evolution Podcast. Today, I'm speaking with Sam McKenzie. Sam's coaching background includes multiple coaching roles for AFL New Zealand. However, he's primarily been a skills coach in rugby union and rugby league, specializing in kicking and high ball catching. He's worked across the youth, community, and professional ranks, including the Auckland Rugby Academy and the New Zealand Warriors NRL team. Sam completed his Masters of Sport and Exercise at AUT University, researching first 15 rugby players' perceptions of their coaching environment. He also worked for Auckland Rugby and was influential in changing their structure of youth sport, shifting the focus to the player experience rather than performance. In March 2020, Sam relocated to Melbourne, becoming the coaching content and learning lead for the AFL, leading the design and delivery of the coaching and learning content across Australia. Sam is passionate about the humanistic approach to sport and coaching, spending the last decade in national and regional sporting organizations across both player and coach development. As a coach, coach developer, and researcher, he brings academic research on coaching pedagogy to practitioners through adult learning strategies. So welcome to the podcast, Sam.
Thanks very much, Rob.
Thanks for taking the time. Obviously, it's always a bit tricky when you've got different time zones and different hemispheres. So thanks for getting the logistics sorted and getting on.
Yeah, no worries. And I'm still getting my head around, like, I moved, and we're only 2 hours different from moving from home to here, but even then trying to figure out what everyone else in different parts of the world is, so no worries.
So for those who haven't come across you before, and I'm guessing, you know, obviously having a mainly UK-based audience and you being based in Melbourne now, probably won't have, give us a bit of a background in terms of your kind of sporting path as a youngster and how that evolved and how you've ended up in the role that you're doing today.
Yeah. It's interesting. It kind of sounds cliche now, I guess, you know, the standard, just got into sport. It's always part of my life. The old man was really into his sport as well. So kind of just ended up following him into things. He was the one, he classic, took me down to the cricket club when I was 4. I think I remember they actually didn't have any sort of under fives cricket. So he started up a little thing for kids because I was so keen to get into it. And then playing the rugby, basketball, tennis, bit of golf, a bit of hockey through school. So kind of just played a bit of everything. Dad was certainly a big influence. He was actually quite young when he had me. So he was only about 20, 21. And so he helped coach our teams and stuff. But then by the time I sort of got a bit older, I was actually able to play with him. So I played basketball with him, played premier cricket with him. And then also as I got a bit older, we started playing AFL, even though I was living in New Zealand, we're playing AFL in New Zealand together as well. So kind of, I sort of dabbled in a whole lot of different sports. Cricket and basketball were my primary sports up until I left school, when AFL kind of, I started working in AFL and then playing AFL as well. And was lucky enough to play for New Zealand in AFL and kind of got stuck into that. And at the same time, working with them and actually getting into that player and coach development space, which then sort of led me into doing a little bit more work in that area, and then running one of the regions in New Zealand, and then bouncing out of that and thinking, man, if I want to get into a bigger sport, I'm going to have to do a bit more research. So I decided to go back to university and do a master's at AUT. So I did my master's there, which actually led to me getting a role with Auckland Rugby in coach development. And then now I'm lucky enough to be at the AFL over in Melbourne, looking after coach learning there. So that's kind of, I guess, you kind of work through you just end up playing sport as a kid and you just love it. And I just always wanted to be involved in it. And then luckily now I sort of work in it.
Hmm. So AFL is not a sport that people would really associate with New Zealand, is it?
No, it's not. It's still pretty minor. It's quite funny as I've gone through. So I worked with AFL New Zealand. I was there for about 6 years. And then I did Auckland Rugby for 2.5 or 3 years. And then now with the AFL, in Australia, and I kind of look at it like when I was at AFL New Zealand, I was doing coach development, and I reckon I could name every single coach in New Zealand off the top of my head. And then I was at Auckland Rugby, we had 1,600 coaches. And then now at AFL, I think we're about 35,000. So the scale has certainly increased as I've got through these roles. But it was a sport that I just really loved. It was just one of those ones that that just sort of seemed to fit with me. I probably wasn't big enough to play rugby. I sort of stopped playing rugby when I was 13 and sort of stuck with basketball and cricket through my secondary school years. But then my dad played, because he was a fullback in rugby, so he played his AFL in the summer, which we play in, back in New Zealand. So he used to play, and then one of my little brothers started playing. So I was like, oh, maybe when I left school, I was like, oh, maybe I can give a bit of contact sport another go. I'd sort of put in a little bit more weight. And so got into it and then just realised I loved it. Like the skills, the transferable skills that I had from basketball and all those other sports, I could use my fitness, the running, jumping, marking, and just had to kind of teach myself how to kick. Which is, funnily enough, like when you're in the AFL guy in New Zealand, it then leads into a whole lot of other things. So by teaching myself how to kick, I kind of went through that process of, I guess, coaching. And that's kind of landed me into a few things where I was coaching our helping coach our under 18 New Zealand team. I was doing a whole lot of other stuff, and then kind of when I moved into rugby, started looking into skills coaching. So doing some kicking coaching, high ball coaching, these skills that AFL is kind of the bread and butter that were coming into rugby a lot more as the kicking game was expanding, the cross kicks and everything. And obviously in rugby league, that's another area that's really big for them. So I kind of got into a bit of skills coaching. And then, funnily enough, I sort of, just through a really weird circle of events of running a session for a team, and then had someone who then knew someone else, ended up doing some skill coaching for the Warriors, so the NRL team there. And for the last couple of years, I was their kicking and high ball coach. And then obviously working with Auckland Rugby, when you're in that setup, I end up doing a whole lot with their academy as well.
Mm. Yeah, I was just thinking that when you were describing your old man as a fullback, I think that's quite a complementary skill set to go between the two sports in terms of catch pass, high ball, and, you know, obviously crossfield kicking and stuff. So do you see a lot of players now in New Zealand that do both codes, like a summer and winter thing, or not so much?
Certainly, AFL kind of targeted itself as the summer sport, as a complementary sport. It's not going to compete with football, basketball, rugby, but certainly you get a lot of kids who've come through our system who then have gone on and done pretty well in other sports. I mean, I remember like David Fusatu with the Warriors, he played under 16 New Zealand AFL. There's a kid playing for the Chiefs now, Ngatoa Koi, and I remember him at school going and delivering a school session for an AFL, and he was this 13-year-old kid. Kind of big, his big 13-year-old, big frizzy hair, sort of come bounding in, and then he ended up playing in a whole lot of our representative teams, and is now has a professional contract with the Chiefs, which is kind of, they're the ones you kind of look back and think, you know, maybe something that we did helped him out because we gave him a skill set that he could transfer, and he became a sort of more well-rounded athlete that allowed him to be successful. So it certainly is a complementary sport in that sense.
Hmm. So in terms of your day-to-day work, we've kind of mentioned a little bit around just that love of the active lifestyle and being a sporty kid or a sportsman. So is there another kind of underlying driver for what you do now? Has that changed, or is it still just that authentic love of the game?
Yeah, so this is where I find it really interesting, because when I reflect back, there's a little bit of evidence out there that shows, yeah, humans are pretty wired so that the negative sticks. You know, evolutionarily, it makes sense. You know, if you learn don't go into that bush because there's a lion there, that sticks, and you probably won't go into that bush again. And as I reflect back, why I sort of got into the player and coach development, a lot of it comes down to some kind of experiences that I would say were negative. Yet it was just kind of ironic because sport's been so good. Like, I love sport, and I've had so many great experiences. Yet why I kind of decided I wanted to go down this way, and what kind of drives me, I guess, is seeing some of these things happen that I'm like, that doesn't seem great. There has to be a better way to do it, and maybe I can be someone who can drive that change a little bit. And I always think I come from a big family, so I'm the oldest of. There's about 40 grandkids in our family. I'm the oldest of five, but I'm the oldest of 25 grandkids. I'm like, dad's side of the family. And so I was actually closer to age with my aunties and uncles. So my youngest uncle, he's about 10 years older than me. And then in my mum's side of the family, I was right in the middle. And everyone around me had another cousin who was the same age. And I was stuck in the middle where it was about 3 years either side. That's where the other cousins were. And so I didn't really want to play with the younger ones. I always wanted to play with the older ones. And on my dad's side, I always wanted to play like with my uncle and everything. And it always sort of stuck with me, this feeling of injustice when they didn't want to do that. You know, they didn't, or they treated me like a little kid or whatever. And it sort of always stuck with me. And I always thought, like, this feeling of, like, don't forget this feeling, because when you're older, don't treat a kid like that. So there's this kind of feeling which it just came from. And, you know, it makes it sound like I was, like, left alone all the time. But I wasn't when I was growing up. It was always really fun. But just these little experiences I had where someone was too busy to play, or the older kids decided they wanted to go off. I kind of thought, no, when I'm older, I don't want to treat the kids like that. I want to remember this feeling. And then it kind of rolled into a whole lot of other experiences that I had once I was actually playing sports. So, like, I remember I've actually played, like, two games of football, I think, when I was about 5 years old. And it's hilarious. The only memory I've got is that I never got the ball. And the one time I got it, it was for a throw. And I was standing there and I was trying to figure out who to throw it with. And this is the only memory I've got, is the coach telling me who to throw it to, which was the fastest kid in the team, so he could go and score a goal. And so after two games, I just said to Dad, I don't want to play. So then he was quite happy about that, because it meant he could take me down to the rugby club and we could get stuck into some rugby. So it would just remember that. And then I actually stopped playing rugby when I was 13. And so I turned up to secondary school. I really loved my basketball. So I'd made the senior, the junior top basketball team. And I went in to the rugby team, which was that I missed the trials because of the basketball trials. And so I was in the under 55 B team, which was the worst team in the school. I just automatically got put in it. And Tuesday nights was basketball game nights if you're a junior. And so I turned up on a Tuesday to the first training and said to the coach, I walked up to him, never met him before. I said, hi, my name's Sam. I'm in this team, but I can't train on a Tuesday night because I've got basketball games. But I can train on a Thursday and I'll be at the game on a Saturday. And I've never met him before. And he just turned, well, he said, in this team, you've got to train both nights of the week. He said, so you're going to have to choose. And I said, oh, thanks. Shook his hand. Said, it's really nice to meet you. I'm going to go play basketball. And I never came back. And so I never went back. I never went back to rugby. And it's just a ridiculous thing. I look back at that and I go, that's ridiculous. I was 13 years old. I was never going to be in a whack. But, you know, when I got older, I started playing contact sport again with AFL. You know, I played at a decent level in New Zealand. And when I remember living in Auckland, and I'd moved down to Wellington for work with AFL, and I'd come back to Auckland, and I was about 27. And I was, you know, all my mates were playing in an under 85 rugby team. And I was under 85s. I was playing contact sport. I didn't have anything really I was doing in winter. The only reason I never went and played with them is because I didn't feel comfortable about playing the sport, because I hadn't played it since I was 12 years old. And maybe if I played it for another couple of years at secondary school, I'd have that confidence, oh yeah, I played it at school. At secondary school, I can come and play. And so they lost someone to the sport. One coach, he won't remember who I am. You know, he wouldn't have had no idea that he was the defining impact on my sporting career in rugby. I'm not involved in a club. You know, luckily, I just through work, because I end up working in the space, I sort of end up circling back, coming by a really weird route to be a skills coach. But I stopped playing the game. And we talk about, you know, participation numbers dropping and things like that. Something as simple as that seems a bit ridiculous that happened at 13 years old. So he kind of had that. And then there were a few other little sort of experiences that I had with coaches and things where I thought, well, they just don't really get me. Well, there's no connection, I guess. Like, I remember playing for the first 11 in our school, and we're playing a traditional down at Christchurch. And I was in batting, and we'd been having a bit of a tough run as a team. And I was out in the middle, and we lost a wicket. And the next guy came in, and he walked up to me, and, you know, you normally go punch gloves or whatever, and he just first thing he said to me, he goes, "Oh, well, I'm dropped." And I was like, "What? What do you mean? Yeah, we're trying to save a game for our school." And he said, "Oh yeah, just before I came in, a coach told me, he said, if you don't score any runs this time, you're dropped." And I'm sort of thinking, going, like, what? And like, this is ridiculous. Like, you can't tell a guy that just is coming out to bat. And, you know, the coach just sort of thought, oh, you know, you sort of hit him up. And he said, "Oh, I just thought it might motivate him." And you just sit there going, well, like, you know, what the heck's going on there? So, but do you not understand? Like, it just is like, this seems like such poor coaching. So, you know, and I understand, and I can look at it now and go, yeah, I can see what he was trying to do, but it just shows a real lack of connection with the athlete, and understand. I could have told you that's not the person to say that to. You could probably tell it to someone else because that might fire them up, but this guy is definitely not going to. So we sort of, yeah, had those experiences that kind of made me think, okay, well, actually I could, you know, I could do that better, or I could be the change. I could be the reason that someone kid doesn't have to go through that experience. And that sort of has driven me. And maybe it was just, I felt, it's that whole, you know, goes back to when I was growing up and just thinking, you know, I don't want to treat someone like how I did that time, you know, and so maybe thinking that I could be maybe a bit of a difference. There's a bit of a saying by Patch Adams that really sticks with me, and it's like, the reason adults should look like they're having fun is to give kids a reason to want to grow up. And that sort of has resonated with me, and I think it comes back to that experience that, like, I had, that it was kind of like this. Sometimes I just feel like as adults forgot what it's like to be a kid, or forgot, you know, like forgot, don't know how to like understand kids. And so I didn't want to be that person. I wanted to remember what it's like, and to try and understand them. And as I've got older, it becomes harder and harder to try and remember that. And so it's about, you know, asking them and trying to talk to them and engaging with them. And like, I'm pretty lucky. I've got, 24 cousins who are younger than me. The youngest one's one or two now, I think. So I've spent my whole life engaging with kids and trying to learn how to entertain them. I'm the king of the grandkids, so I'm the one at family things who has to entertain them and keep them busy and everything. So I've kind of learned how to, you know, how to deal with a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old and a 2-year-old sort of all in the same night. But that's kind of probably, I think that sort of sums up a little bit of sort of where the drive comes from a little bit, and why I've ended up where I am.
No, it's good. I mean, I guess, you know, the kind of running theme there is the fact that we can do better, isn't it? Like, you know, there's so many negative experiences.
Yeah.
And you're one person who's had multiple negative experiences. What about those other kids who maybe didn't even like, you know, basketball in the first place and have been turned off, you know? So you're a sporty kid who got turned off a few sports. What about someone who's not sporty who gets turned off straight away? You know, that's a big problem there.
Yeah, and you've sort of hit the nail on the head there. I think that's the problem. I mean, there's a John McEnroe. So when Arthur Ashe, when he was playing tennis, you know, he was doing a lot of stuff for minorities and getting rackets in the hands of kids who maybe didn't normally have access to the game. And when he passed away, John McEnroe ended up being the person to take over sort of that role. And he there's a quote he was saying. I can't remember it, so I'll just paraphrase it, but he was sort of saying that, you know, his biggest worry was that the best tennis player ever to live would never get a racket in his hand. And I remember reading that, and I think it was there when I was at uni and reading that quote and going, oh yeah. And as I've kind of developed, obviously my fear isn't so much about not getting it in their hand, but that they got the racket in their hand and then they put it down again because they had a shite time. Like, that's the worry, and I feel like that just happens too much. And kids who are teetering on the edge, and they're the ones we want to try and get in the game, because there are kids who just might not engage with it, but if they're on the edge, that's the one that you want to tip to stay in the game or stay in the bowl. So,
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Like, when I look back, and I know speaking to other people, is that often the flip side of that. So as you said, a negative experience can really turn you off, but a positive experience with a coach can really fire you up and be, you know, a turning point for getting involved in sport for the long term and wanting to become a coach. So are there any kind of, on the flip side, are there any kind of positive influences aside from obviously your dad who kind of got you involved in sport or affected your coaching methodology moving forward? Any kind of significant people?
I kind of sort of learned as I've gone through it as well. I mean, I had a really great basketball coach, Damien Wootton. He was awesome, and I remember he he was someone who, like, he just, I guess he showed he cared about you, and he would engage with you. And I remember we had to, when I was, like, I wasn't as strong when I was younger, so I used to put his basketball and I used to shoot from the hip, so it's really low down. And as I got a bit older, I remember I missed a game-winning shot from the corner. I shot it, it's actually an air ball, it was pretty bad. And I remember him after the game saying, hey, we're going to have to redo your shot. We're going to have to remodel it. We're going to have to change it so you're shooting from higher up. And he spent a whole summer working with me and changing that and getting it right and having faith in me. You know, he named me captain when I was seventh form, and so I had to have that connection with him because I was the connection between, you know, the team and him to a degree. But he was someone who, you know, it was probably one of my first ever real values session, like a proper value sessions around behaviours and values. And he kind of, it must have been around the time Coach Carter came out, because we had a few Coach Carter moments where he, you know, would turn up and there's no balls in the gym because our school had a system where you got grades just on effort and things like that. And if it was too low, you'd just end up running the whole time. The balls wouldn't, the door would still be locked for where the balls were when we turned up, and we knew that could be a bit of a tough session. But he sort of did it out of a place of care. You know, we ended up making a national final. We won 37 games straight, made a national final, lost that to a couple of future Tall Blacks, but then they won the following 2 years, you know. So just showed, you know, there was a bit of a development plan in place, and he was the leader. So that was a really positive experience for me, just because he cared, you know. And I'm still, like, I'm Facebook friends with him and still pops up every now and then on things. And he comments on, I've had a few sort of these sort of podcast things that I've shared, and he always pops up and has encouraging words. So it's kind of someone who is just there for you. So that was a really positive experience for me.
Hmm. So how would you kind of describe your current, you know, evolution of your coaching model or philosophy? Is there any kind of guiding principles you operate with, or any thoughts that you kind of try to stick to? You obviously kind of have mentioned around the importance of fun and the importance of positive experiences. Is there any other guiding lights for you?
I guess the kind of first one is just trying to remember who you're there for. I think that's a big one. You know, I'm not necessarily there for me. I'm there for them. You know, it's for the players, it's for the participants, for the athletes, or, you know, whatever level you're working at. Just remembering that you're there for them. So how can I do best by them? It's not necessarily about what I think they need. You know, that comes into it because, you know, hopefully I can see where we can help them. But it's actually, well, what do they need? You know, because it might not be some technical stuff. It might just be a simple mental stuff that they need, and I can help them out. It might just be a confidence. They just need to be a little bit more confident. They just need someone to tell them, hey, like, you are good enough. You can do this. You know, I believe in you. I've got faith in you. Another guiding one is just, like, it's kind of like, you know, what is it that I want out of it? Well, I just want that anyone who comes in and comes into contact with me or interacts with me is better off because of it. And that can be in a whole lot of different ways. It doesn't necessarily mean they're better skilled athletes. It could just be that they're better off because they had a good time, you know, that they enjoyed it, or they learned something about themselves. So if that's a kind of my goal, and it sounds a bit vague, but it's kind of can come in and they're better off because of it, I think that, well, that's great. You can go home pretty happy. And then I guess the other, like, I guess a principle that I do is, I'm certainly trying to be as evidence-based as I can with what I do and use that. So try and almost be that conduit between the you know, the academic side and the practitioner side, to try and use that and try and model that sort of behavior and actually saying, hey, you know, here's some things that we've seen might have worked, let's try them.
So tell us a bit around your current role at the AFL. What's kind of your remit in terms of the side of coach development and producing content out? What does that look like? Is that mainly the theory side of things, a bit of practical? What does that look like?
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting time. It's a bizarre time to move country because I think I worked about 12 days before COVID really hit and we sort of all got stood down. But I'm still doing some work with them and everything. And we're sort of towards the end of September, everything should right itself and then we'll be good to go. So it's a new role with them. So, you know, about now we probably wouldn't have been really seeing exactly what that role was. but it, I mean, the title's coaching, content and learning lead. So it's really about trying to figure out how we can reach as many of our coaches with some of the learning content we want. You know, what do we want them to learn through our online platform? So we have a Coach AFL platform, which is a learning management system that allows us to reach as many coaches as we can, but also link up with, I guess, a coach developer principle. So how do we link that in? And we're very much of the belief that, you know, a lot of coach learning happens on the job, you know, whilst they're coaching. And sort of coach development for a very long time has been, you do everything before the season, so in the off season and pre-season, and then kind of just let them go. But yet that's not actually how people learn and actually the best way to support coaches. So my role is about trying to come up with some ways and some strategies that we can embed our coach learning in their context, in their world, because that's where it's actually going to help. So kind of a big job, but we'll, and I'll tell you what, there's been a lot of thinking over the last couple of months with a little bit of downtime about how we might be actually able to go and do that. And it's kind of mixing our formal, you know, we've got some really good accreditation stuff. My first like 3 days were on some of our accredited programs. And I was really impressed. Like, it was really awesome. There's some big heavy hitters delivering some really high level content to coaches that were just soaking it up, which was awesome to see. And then my role's kind of, you know, we've got that accreditation. We're pretty good with that. But it's actually like the gaps in between, you know, the filling in the cracks and going, how do we get that ongoing continuous learning? It's a bit of a culture within the AFL, and coaches feel like they're supported, you know, and they can take things, they can apply it, they can reflect and improve.
That's really good. That's a few conversations that I've had with multiple kind of coaches. Kelvin Giles along as one of them, is that kind of, I guess, the situation that we find ourselves in a lot of the time, where, you know, grassroots coaches go and get, you know, a formal qualification, or you know, they're level one or level two, whatever, and then they're just left for 10 years to kind of do what they're doing, and there isn't that ongoing mentorship or that ongoing input when actually the rubber hits the road, because it's easy to learn about coaching and running drills and stuff in classrooms and on a coaching course when everyone's stood where they're meant to be and behaving as they're meant to be and all that kind of stuff. But in reality, when people go out to their actual context, you know, especially places in Australia where you might be in the outback or you might be in, you know, in the city, things are really different from the textbook, aren't they? And being able to apply some of those things and make it specific to your arena is really important.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I mean, I was quite lucky. I went through being in New Zealand and working in rugby. It kind of can open some doors for you there in terms of coaching. You get access to some great people. And Sport New Zealand have been doing some amazing stuff in the coach development space and setting up the coach developer system. So I was lucky enough to be on sort of their trainer program for a year last year, and working across the system and seeing all the different codes, but it really is around, you know, how do we support coaches in their environment? You know, how do we support it and how do we make it contextual for them so they can relate anything they're learning to what they're actually going to do? Because if they can't do that, you're not going to get any learning, because they won't retain it and they won't be able to transfer it and apply it practically. So there's a lot of work being done in that space, and that's just where, you know, that's where the magic happens. That's where we get, the long-term gains out of it, and coaches will be able to develop. And like you say, I mean, it's a tough one, because we often, you know, we set up these accreditation stuff things, and then you get a coach and you go, and the coach is going, oh, I've done my level two, I want to do my level three now, because that's the next thing for me. And you go, well, mate, you're kind of still coaching an under 12 side. You probably need to do another five. You know, you've only been coaching for 2 or 3 years. You probably need to be coaching another 5 years, really, to be a level three kind of coach. But we don't have anything to support them through those 5 years to make them ready, you know, to help them out. And they sort of say, it's, you know, experience of and by itself isn't enough to develop. You need to have that experience with reflection. You need to, and, you know, observe other coaches and be able to reflect and then have that interaction with a mentor or a coach developer or anyone who's able to bounce ideas and drive that self-reflection.
That's really interesting. That's kind of a internal discussion I've been having the last couple of days around CPD and learning and stuff like that. Is, I mean, especially during COVID, where the, you know, there's been webinars coming out your ears and, you know, you could spend every hour of the day on your laptop listening to someone talk about what they do in their context. But there's that kind of that difference between education and entertainment. Like a lot of the times when you go to CPD and you don't see how it's relevant or how you could apply it into your context, it's entertaining to listen to, but it doesn't really change your practice. Whereas if you come with a specific problem in mind and you go and search out, right, I've got this issue, I need to find a solution to that issue, there's way more urgency around your learning in terms of how does this work? How can I apply this? How can this fit? And it will actually change what you do tomorrow. Whereas I think there's sometimes there can be, you know, the kind of hype around jumping on the webinar with this top coach or listening to this person talk about this, when actually you go, mate, you're coaching under 12s. Those principles are way too high level for that. Like, yeah. I understand, you know, that you're interested, but realistically, you're probably better off learning a bit more about pedagogy or a bit more about, you know, managing behavior or whatever it is, something that's, that is going to help you rather than entertain you.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny. I mean, I've had a bit of downtime. So I've been doing a lot of like reading and learning and listening and watching webinars. And it's quite funny. A couple of the ones I, because I guess I'm in this world and I'm constantly trying to make sure I relate what I'm learning to my situation and how I can apply it. I remember there's been a couple where I've actually got a bit frustrated because I've had to go back and listen to parts of it again because I hear something and then it resonates with me and I start thinking how I can apply it in my world and then realize I've missed, you know, 3 or 4 minutes of what's been going on. So I've had to go back, you know, and often these webinars and stuff, there's no time for that reflection and setting that aside and saying, actually, because a lot of it's just a presentation as opposed to, well, let's engage with you and let's get you thinking, you know. And I'm just lucky that because I've been working in that space for a while now, I've now managed to, through sort of a habitual behavior and kind of driving it all the time, my mind's now starting to work like that. And it's taken a long time to get there. But it's quite funny that a few times I've sort of realized, oh, I've been sitting, I was on the tram going, when I was still working, I was going to work and I was listening to something and then realized I'd missed the last 10 minutes because something's been whirling around in my head around how something I can apply to my coaching or at work.
Sounds familiar. Yeah, I think it's an interesting one, the whole accreditation thing and like what you're saying around coaches wanting to go to the next level. And part of the problem with the way a lot of these things are structured is that they tend to be structured in terms of a progression towards older athletes, don't they? Like this, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm not aware of a, you know, any accreditation pathway that is geared towards becoming a world-class under 16s coach or a world-class under 18s coach. They're always about, okay, this is for minis, this is for adolescents, this is for first team rugby, and this is for pros, and we're going to work our way through this. Whereas actually that kind of leads to a bias where the assumption is if you're not a very good coach, you're operating with kids, and if you're a really good coach, you must be in the pros.
Yeah, yeah. And we always used to say in our things, you know, if we gave Steve Hansen a group of under eights, he might struggle a bit because he hasn't probably spent a lot of time in that space. But I think you're right. And it's probably something that I've kind of, you've just prompted me, something I've been thinking about. I mean, I'm probably biased. Like, I really have I really love that sort of 13 to 20 year old age group. I guess as an age group, in terms of where you can, I feel like you can have such a big impact on them, not only just in their sport and setting them up for success in that, but also in life, because they're just going through all these different stages of development and you can help shape a bit of that for them. And so I always look at, and I've sort of thrown it out a couple of times going, you know, what we pay, you know, these coaches at the top level, you know, in the professional sports, we look at the, you know, who are running the Premier League teams or running the Super Rugby teams, you know, they're the ones who get the big money. Yet they're getting a whole lot of players that are kind of, you know, they're not finished products because everyone's always learning and developing. Yet they're getting a whole lot of people that a lot of their behaviours and their habits and everything have been set up when they're younger. So why are we not saying, actually, probably the most important coach and where we need our best coach is actually in like our academy system or in our system working with players when they're sort of 15 to 20, getting them ready for that. Because once we hand them over, they're kind of, you know, they are almost who they are. And whilst they'll still learn and develop, because we know that that always happens, we kind of are saying, well, no, actually our best coaches always get older. And like you say, our accreditation system's almost saying the same thing, that the better coach you get, the higher you should move up, as opposed to, well, no, how about you just be the best under 16 coach in the world? Because you're going to have a massive impact, probably more of an impact than you have on a 25-year-old or 30-year-old player. You know, for that 16-year-old, you're really setting them up.
Mm. No, it's a really interesting debate. And I do think I mean, I don't know what the impact of budgets worldwide will have on this, but I do think maybe at least prior to Corona, we were starting to see a bit of a shift in thinking towards that. Like, I know within the strength and conditioning industry, there are people who are on very sizable wages at professional academies because they're recognized for that specific purpose of being the best in the world with the youth athletes. Or, you know, their specific remit is, do you know what, you're going to work with the academy and your long-term progression plan is not to work to the first team, it's to become the head of performance for the academy.
So I do think
we were, you know, when resources were flowing, maybe things were a bit better. I don't know what the situation will be in the next 12 months.
And it's the same. It's the same here. I mean, in the AFL clubs, you know, they're having to cut. They've had to cut a lot of staff at the professional level because, I mean, you know, there's an argument that maybe that they were slightly too big. You know, there are a lot of coaches. There are, like, each club had a lot of coaches, but it meant that when kids were coming in, there were a lot of development coaches. So coaches are looking. You just kind of hope that they can say, "Oh, actually, you know, that's actually an age group that we really need to look after, and actually, that's a great coach, and maybe we need to value that a little bit higher than what we have been."
So that kind of leads nicely into this next question. So I'm really keen to discuss some of the research you did with your masters at AUT. I mean, in the UK, certainly, you know, there's a bit of hype in the rugby world around, you know, TV show like The Season, where they were following around some of the teams in that, you know, rugby schools championship. So tell us about, you know, first of all, I guess the kind of overall premise in terms of what you were trying to look at, and then some of the research findings that came out of that.
Yeah, so I guess one of the first things to give a bit of background. So like I just mentioned before, I've got a real interest in the development of players, and probably where it stems from is that I was kind of always interested, like, what actually helps to get people to, like, the elite stage. I guess that was when I was younger. That was probably the sort of, like, the lens I was looking at. It's going, you know, I was really interested in what is it that people do when they're younger that allow them to be successful when they're older, and so I really had an interest in that, I guess, the development of players. And then as I started working, it became a lot more realizing that, well, actually coach development and player development almost, like, inherently combine, because the coaches have the biggest impact on the players as they come through. So that was kind of what led me, I guess, that's another reason, I guess, why I've ended up in coach development. But in New Zealand, like, rugby is obviously the biggest sport. Secondary school rugby is really interesting. Like, it was getting a lot of media coverage around the time that I was kind of looking at my topic. And I knew I wanted to do something in kind of the coaching and development player space. And there was, like, the increased professionalisation of the sport. And also some of the, and along with that came some sort of what you might call some morally interesting decisions being made by coaches or schools themselves. And there's a lot of stuff around players getting scholarships and all this environment that was being created for, you know, games being on TV and everything like that. So I kind of wanted to look at that. And so I took the 1A competition in Auckland. So that's the top schoolboy competition in Auckland. And Auckland is the biggest provincial union in the country, the biggest city in New Zealand and the biggest PU. And what I decided is that with youth sport, one of the problems is that it's a lot of adults talking about it. So it's a lot of adults talking to adults. And often we just don't get the player voice. So I decided I wanted to talk to the players and wanted to talk to them. So it was about the first 15 players' perceptions of their coaching environment. So just asking them around some of the behaviour of the coaches and kind of what they felt about it. And I wasn't really looking so much at what the coaches were doing, but it was more around whatever they were doing, how it made the players feel and their experience of that. And then how that affected their experience of actually playing secondary school rugby as well. So that's kind of, I guess, the big background to it.
And so what was kind of the format of that in terms of, was it, you know, written surveys, was it kind of informal chat groups? How did you kind of engineer those conversations with the school boys?
Yeah, so I ran focus groups. And so what we did is that we had three of the teams. There's 12 teams in the team, and so we sort of three of the teams, and I had in each one about the 8 to 10 kids from the team. They're all 16 to 18, so that they were all players who'd sort of been in the team for a year or two, and they were teams that had they were teams that had been in the 1A comp the last sort of year and the year that I was doing it. So they'd been in the pro, they weren't someone who'd just come up and so hadn't had much experience. They'd all been involved in the competition for a year or two, for the last couple of years. And just kind of ran some focus groups and so just talk to them. And like anyone who knows, talking to a group of 16 to 18 year old boys can be a bit tough at times. They're not the most open group, especially some of the rugby boys. But it was quite interesting because they actually were quite keen once you got them going. I mean, this is their world. So this is what they, you know, this is their day to day. This is what they live. And they're actually really keen to talk. And at the end of a focus group, I'd sort of say, hey, look, thanks very much for talking to me. And, you know, you know, how did you feel? I know it's a bit weird having some random guy come and talk to you about a whole lot of stuff. And they said, it's great. They said, no one, I said, has anyone ever talked to you about this? They're like, nah, no one ever does. They said, can you come back next week? Because we'll probably have some more stuff to talk about from this week's training. So they're actually really keen to have someone there and actually talk about their experiences. So that was kind of how it was set up.
So what were some of the kind of, I guess, feedback is maybe the word, or some of the themes that came out from players, I guess, positively and negative around those perceptions of coaches in that 1A comp?
Yeah. So there are sort of five themes that kind of drew out, five big ones. I get the first two, I guess, weren't so much about the coaching, which was quite interesting because, again this is one of the things that comes through with it. Is that you don't always know what you're going to get. And the first couple were actually just about the competition, I guess, and what it means for them as players. So the first one, I guess, was just around the fact that it's like the status of the first 15 comp. So you talk about that, you know, you're over in Scotland and seeing the season and all the stuff and the kind of, you know, what does a schoolboy comp in New Zealand look like? Well, for their players in their world, it was a big deal. Yeah, it gave them a lot of status. So they were a big deal in their environment. You know, people who, one of the kids said, it didn't matter if you were the worst player in the team, you were still a first 15 player and everyone knew who you were. So it gave them a lot of status. And they felt that, you know, they're a bit biased, but they certainly felt that the Auckland, the 1A comp was the best schoolboy rugby competition in the world. That was the prestige of playing in it, so it was a big deal. And then the second one, kind of, that wasn't so much about the coaching, it was just about this feeling of brotherhood. All teams said the word brotherhood. So it was about this connectedness that they had with each other. And that was driven mainly peer-to-peer. So actually being part of this, they, you know, they're quite perceptive kids. So that's the same there, actually. It's out, we see each other every day, and it's an experience that we're never going to have again. Because once we leave school, you know, we'll go play club rugby, we'll see people on Tuesday, Thursday and game day. But here we get to see, we get to play with people that we see every day, our best mates at school, and it creates that really that strong bonding feeling. And the coaches, so it's not actually necessarily driven by the coaches, but the coaches can help. So they, you know, a lot of the coaches are really good around sort of having these values sessions. So, you know, the players have a lot of autonomy and buy-in into what their team's about off the field anyway. So this whole, you know, what are we about? What happens if someone falls out of line? You know, the team's talked about that. When someone broke some of the team rules, they kind of were able to help decide what the punishment was and then and when that player could come back. So that there was a bit of that autonomy in the values section. So that could help create that brotherhood. But then I guess you start to get to some of the on-field stuff. So whilst off-field, they had a lot of autonomy. On-field, it completely changed. So this is where some of the coaching behaviour started to come in. And really talked about coach control. So this is an age group, you know, 16 to 18, the tops of teams, it's a pretty high level. A lot of these kids will be rolling on to making academies and stuff, but yet they were really controlled around what they can play, control of the game plan, so on field. And then they felt that they couldn't express themselves on the field, which is a, you know, there were a few little things that happened, like teams they felt their scrum was going really well, and so they got a penalty, the kicker wasn't kicking that well, they had their scrum, suddenly the tee gets run on from the coaches, because the coaches say, no, we're taking the three, and I sort of asked, well, how did you feel that, and they just said, well, the kicker just yelled out, just yelled out, fuck, and then that was it. They said they had to do it because that's what the coach said, and they felt like, hey, our scrum's dominating, we can't do it, but we've got to go do it. So they felt like they couldn't really do anything. They said, you know, at line-out time, the line-out gets called. The back line off the line-out gets – the back line move off the line-out gets called as well. So we just do it. And actually, the consequence of that was that they actually didn't take a lot of ownership of what happened on the field. I remember one of the kids saying, "said, well, if we stuff up, it's not on us. It's on the coach because it was his plan." And, you know, and that they did – when you probe them a little bit more and try to unpack it, they sort of said, well, yeah, if they talked to us a bit more and kind of explained everything and listened to us and gave us the option to listen, you know, so gave us the option to have a say, even if we decide to go with the coach, you know, if the coach says, well, this is the way we're going to do it, we feel like we're part of it. But they felt that it didn't matter when they had the conversation. They knew that they were going to lose. If they brought anything up, they knew that the coach wasn't really going to listen to them. And so the coach was controlling what they did, which is a really interesting sort of dynamic, because the players don't have a lot of, in a school environment, you know, you're talking about, it's already quite a hierarchical environment in the school, and you know, teachers sort of are above the students, and it's not a lot of opportunity to kind of have that sort of robust discussion or anything like that you might want in like an elite team anyway. You know, you want to have that ability for players to have autonomy and have that empowerment. And so there's kind of power dynamic, because actually where the players probably did have their ability to kind of express themselves is actually on the field, even though the coaches are the ones telling them what to do. But generally it can't be that the players go against what the coach says, because that's quite overt. Like if a coach says do this and they go and do something else, it's quite overt. But there was this great story where sometimes the players, like that's the power dynamic, they could show their power by just not doing something. So I was asking one of the teams, and I sort of asked them about, you know, how does it all work with their reviewing of games and everything. They said, yeah, they have their game. They kind of clip it. The coaches will clip it on a Sunday, and then on Monday they'll have to be prepared to do a review. And I was like, oh, cool. And I said, who comes up with all your moves? And they said, oh, the coaches do. And I said, oh, are there any moves you don't think will work? And they said, yeah, we've got a few of those. And I said, oh, and what do you do with them? And they said, oh, we just call them our training moves because we're never going to do them in a game. And I was like, what do you mean? It's like, yeah, we practice them, but we don't, they're not going to work, so we don't do them. I said, oh, do you ever tell your coaches that? I said, no. And I said, well, why not? They go, oh, we don't want them to think that we're going to overthrow them or something like that. You know, we don't want that at all. I said, oh, well, then what happens like in the game? And what happens in your review? I said, oh, well, yeah, actually, to be honest, if we did them in a game, we'd probably review them. And then if they didn't work, they would take them out. But we don't want to do them in a game, because we don't think they're going to work. And so it becomes this really weird cycle, because what happens is that they train them on a Tuesday and Thursday. They don't do them on a Saturday. Because they don't do them on a Saturday, they can't review them on a Monday. And because they can't review them on a Monday, they can't remove them, which means they just train them on Tuesday and Thursday again. And yet the coaches don't know this is going on. So that never happened. So they never get this opportunity to have this discussion, say, hey, well, we're never going to do this. Why are we practicing it? Let's use our time. You know, and they don't have... Well, that's one of the problems, is that they're actually probably overtraining. They're doing a lot of training. But you think, you know, you only have a certain amount of time in a week you can get through. You're wasting 20 minutes of training doing some moves that you're never going to do. It builds up over a season. And because they don't have this relationship where they feel like they can put their hand up and say, hey, oh, this isn't going to work, because the coaches are so controlling in some of the other environments that they are in, they don't have that that ability to do it, and it leads to this kind of cycle, this bizarre cycle that's going round and round.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like that kind of dichotomy of having autonomy in terms of the culture of the team, the values, but then the complete lack of autonomy on the pitch. It's an interesting paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, and it really leads to a feeling like they talked about, they don't feel like they can express themselves. You know, they don't feel like when they get out, you think about why these kids played the game when they're younger, and you know, they're obviously very, very good players, and they've got to where they are because of, you know, their ability, and yet they're all being kind of put in a box. And I mean, as an aside, probably not so much from the research side, but certainly from my experience in working in rugby and working in sport in general at this age group, you find that now they're becoming more and more structured, and you're starting to lose some of that sort of individual flair or that individual brilliance, which kids can do because they have to stay in the structure, which, you know, in the long term, it's creating probably less problem-solving athletes, less adaptable athletes, because they're just kind of doing what they're told, as opposed to learning, being in all these different environments, trying different things. So that's a little bit aside, but that, you're sort of seeing that, and it showcased through here, because you're just seeing, oh, this is why, because they're just players don't feel like they can do what they want to do. They have to do what the coach says.
So what are some of the kind of applications we can take away from the study that, and the themes that you found there? What are some of the take-home messages for coaches?
Yeah, well, I guess the big one is just to talk to your players. Like, that's the big one for me. It's just talk to them, understand them, get to know them, you know. Ask them, what do you think about this? I've been in the focus groups. They're not necessarily the most talkative bunch, but it's actually just trying to connect with them and just ask them some simple things to start with, just to get them going. And then you'll be able to ask some of the big things. One of the other things we found, and this is one of the problems, and this is something that I think all of the coaches need to kind of understand, is just that the expectations and the pressure on these kids were huge. And this is one of the things that sort of really, probably the thing that resonated with me the most, and that it was kind of a bit worrying, was that, yeah, they just felt like the expectation was massive, and there was an expectation of performance, there was an expectation of commitment. So these kids are doing so much training, and it's kind of like, wow, they're doing, you know, two a days, and they found it really hard, and it was impacting on their school, and they felt tired. And also that, and this is one of the worrying ones, I guess, is that they weren't worried about getting better, they're just worried about making mistakes. So there was this real fear of failure, which we know a lot of the evidence is that there's a really, really bad way to get good performance, is if your fear of failure that actually holds you back. And this is a development age group, really. I mean, they're only 16 to 18. So we don't want them to be worried about failure. We want them to be trying things, you know, developing their skill set, becoming really well-rounded athletes. And you only learn that by stuffing up a few times and learning what works and what doesn't. Now, one of the quotes from the kids, he said when he first got into the team, he said, I was just focused on not doing anything wrong because I was too scared. I didn't want to get told off for doing something wrong. I wasn't really thinking of what I could do to get better. It's just don't do anything wrong so you don't get told off. And so the coach behavior in terms of when, you know, they felt that if they did something wrong, they'd get yelled at, and they didn't want to get yelled at. And so I won't do anything wrong. So other players were talking about sometimes some players just pass the ball on because they didn't want to run. They just thought, the safest thing for me to do, whereas for other players, the safest thing for them to do was just to run with the ball because they didn't want to pass it because they were worried that they'd make a mistake. And so you've got these things where these players are making decisions not to try and play the game, but really just not to make mistakes. And that for their development, you're thinking of long-term development and their skill set, that's not where we want to be.
That comes right back to your message earlier around remembering who we're here for, isn't it?
Mm. Exactly. And I mean, coaching in schools, especially school space, and we'll probably touch on it in a little bit, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. You know, there are a lot of pressures on the coaches and the schools themselves. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure for performance because of, you know, the environment that the first 15 competition's in. You know, it's a really highly, you know, high status, which the players know about. Schools are using it as a bit of a, you know, there's an assumption that schools are using it as a bit of a marketing tool as well. You know, if you've got a really good school rugby program, you're going to get lots of people coming in. You get the old boys getting behind it, can generate a little bit of extra money for the school, all that sort of stuff. So, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. So the behavior, you know, the environment helps drive some of that behavior as well. But I guess the last quote that the one that really kind of has the biggest impact for me is just one of the kids was sort of asking around. I asked them, is it different? Is playing first 15 rugby in your experience different to when you were younger? You know, when you were playing, what's the difference? So one of them said, yeah, the only fun I've had was in the under 14s. That's it. Yeah, under 14 rugby, that's where everyone got to express themselves. Like everyone was equal and stuff. As you're young, you sort of enjoy sport. But as you come older, it's commitment. It's all about commitment. And that to me is so, like, I heard it because I was in the room with the kid. But as you look back on it, it's just like, it's commitment. It's all about commitment. Sounds like work. Mm. You know, this is a 16-year-old, 17-year-old kid playing rugby for a school, and it's no longer fun. You know, the only fun was in the under 14s. It's no longer fun for him. It's about commitment, and that's it. So it's a grind. And you think, well, what happens when he gets, you know, 4 or 5 years down the track, and that's his experience of sport, and he goes, after a while, wow, it's just not, I haven't had fun since I was 14. It's been 10 years. Maybe I'll just stop playing. You wonder why we start losing these players in that sort of 22 to 28 age group. You know, we don't have a lot of those players who should be our really good senior club players. If they don't make it as a professional, then that's kind of it.
It's really interesting you mentioned that, because just recently, about a month or maybe even 6 weeks ago, we had a player within the Scottish Rugby set up retire. And I believe he's 23, maybe 24.
Yeah, I heard you talking about that.
And that pretty much, you know, just, you know what, I don't love it anymore. And that's... Yep. It's one of those things, you know, we focus so much on getting someone physically to a level or getting someone skill-wise to a level, but is that sometimes at the cost of that love of the game or that enjoyment or that fun? Yeah. And then actually the pivotal thing that causes them to step back is not the physical side of things or the skill side of things. It's actually, do you know what? I just don't want to be here anymore.
Yeah. And I mean, the hardest thing is that often you won't have these kids, or they won't necessarily be able to articulate that. That's what it is. They just kind of go, oh, I just don't really like it that much. You know, I just thought, oh, I'll go do something else. But actually, that's because the experience that they've had over the last 10 years has just ground them down, you know, because the professionalisation of sport has just been getting younger and younger to get them ready at a younger age to be able to make the next level and the next level, that, and, you know, it kind of keeps filtering down. And so suddenly it's like, that doesn't surprise me that, yeah, after 10 years of it, well, fair enough. You know, like even I think back to when I was at school, we were only training. You know, we basketball team, we made a national final. You know, we were the second best team in the country. And I think we trained like three times a week, maybe. You know, during the season, we might have gone to three times a week. Some of these kids are training, you know, they're doing two a day. So they're training, you know, 6 to 8 times a week, doing more than our professional teams. So at one point, we were looking at school program, we're going, they're doing more than our Mitre 10 team. They're doing more than the Blues, you know, and they're only 16 years old. So I ran a kicking session for a school and was talking to the director of rugby, really good guy, you know, but a big school. And he was sort of saying, he asked me how it went. And I said, look, the players are looking like they're coming along pretty well. They just need to spend a bit of time on their kicking and I think they'll be all right. And he said, yeah, well, he said, you know, you can really tell the ones who are doing stuff in their own time and the ones who aren't. And he said, just not enough of them are doing stuff in their own time to help develop their skills. I sort of had to say, well, I'm not surprised. When are they going to do stuff in their own time?
What time?
They just don't they don't have it. Like, they're training so much structured training stuff that they shouldn't be doing any rugby in their own time because it's just too much, you know, and why would they want to? You have so much structured rugby time that they need that time away from the sport just to get out of it and get out of the head in terms of their rugby head. So that is a really worrying proposition that you've got, you know, and then the people who are in charge of it are going, oh man, they're not doing enough in their own time. It's like, well, yeah, I don't think they will. I think they need time away from the sport. So maybe you need to cut back, and then those kids who really love it and really want to do it, they're the ones who'll go and do the extras because and they're doing it on their own accord, not because they have to. This is this unstructured versus structured stuff. You know, the kids who want to do it and the kids who need it, they'll go and do it, you know, and you can work with those players if those kids who are going to have that professional career. But for a lot of these kids, there's 360 kids playing in the first 15 1A comp. You know, how many of them are actually going to have professional rugby careers? And yet we kind of throw a blanket rule over all these kids and say, you got to do 8 trainings a week. You're not allowed to go play basketball, even though you love basketball, but you've got to play rugby because you might get injured, but you're going to be on the bench. So you're actually not going to play that much, but you can't play rugby. You can't play basketball, sorry. You know, so it's this environment that's been created, which is kind of pushing them, and you can see why kids might bounce out.
So obviously we mentioned, I guess, in a roundabout way, the professionalisation of that kind of school rugby setup in terms of doing 2-a-days and, you know, having clips over the weekend to review for Mondays and things like that. Which are obviously, you know, the drawbacks that lead to maybe burnout, injury, dropout, those kind of things. But what are some of the positive aspects of, you know, increased professionalization. Yeah. Is there anything that's, you know, potentially a positive aspect?
Yeah, look, I'm probably a little bit, like, my view, I'm a little bit biased. I think that it's gone way too far. Like, I'm worried about where it's kind of heading. But I certainly think what are the best bits of kind of having some of that? I certainly think it's some of the people who are able to work in that space. We talked about that a little bit earlier. Is that, you know, it is an age group where you can have a real impact on them, you know, in terms of where they are in the future and the success that they can have, not just on the sporting field, but also on life. You know, you can, and sport's a really good teacher for that, because you can teach resilience and stuff in a really safe environment, things like that. But so you get some really good people working in there. You know, I know you've talked to Craig Harrison, you know, and he spends a lot of time, and he's a really good person, and he's a ridiculously smart man. And he also works in, you know, that age group space because he can, you know, because the environment's created ability for him to have work in there, which means that you've got someone who's very, very intelligent and, you know, and is driven to give the best possible youthful experience and help these kids to be successful in life. And he's working in that space. So you can have some really, really good people. I mean, obviously a drawback is that because there's a bit more money into it, you can have some people who are just looking for the cash and kind of bringing in maybe not some great behaviour. But I certainly think that is an end, you know, in terms of if we look at the way that the game's developing and the game's getting faster and stronger and everything, you know, you're getting players who are getting better and better at younger and younger. And I mean, and the other thing is that in the women's space, you know, the professionalisation is able to drive actually getting women playing the sport, you know, that. And I know in New Zealand with rugby, the women's space has taken off because now they're actually investing in it. And so now, and what we're seeing is that we're actually seeing some of these girls coming through. And I know Auckland last year, their first five was 16 years old, and she's probably going to be one of the best ever women's players ever to have played the game, you know, but she's been getting good coaching since she was a bit younger. But there's another question to say, well, should a 16-year-old be starting in a professional team? So there's, you know, there are drawbacks with it as well. But certainly some of the positives, so the advantages, is that you're starting to see some of that filtered down. But it's the worry is that when you get into it, you know, is, and I kind of just sort of using the term, you know, as the square peg of professional sport into the round hole of youth sport, you know, that 16-year-olds are not just mini adults. You know, they are different people. They are going through all of these different changes in their development, you know, whether it be biological, psychological, social, cognitive, all of these things are happening to them. And we're kind of just taking the things from professional sport and just kind of shoving them on them, as opposed to going, well, actually what's best for them. For the most part, there's some people in the pockets that are doing really, really cool stuff, which is where I talk about those advantages. But we're certainly seeing some horror stories coming out. And you only have to look at some of the horrible stuff that has happened in terms of some of the environments of HP Sport where they have young kids. You look at some of the gymnastics stuff that's come out from overseas where they are dealing with kids, but it's a super elite level. And you go, well, if that professionalisation keeps seeping down, is that what we're going to start seeing?
So we've obviously already mentioned around, you know, just creating that connection with players and asking them, you know, for their input on, you know, be it training or be it, you know, the culture of the team. Are there any other pieces of advice you'd give to coaches based on your research and your findings?
I mean, the big one is talk to your players, like get to know them. Also take a bit of the evidence-based approach. Like one of the things that was interesting to me was that you had these kids having 6 o'clock gym sessions in the morning. So some of them had to get up at 4:30 to get to school for 6 o'clock for a gym session. Now, if you actually look at adolescents and you look at the circadian rhythm of a kid, what actually happens is that the circadian rhythm shifts. So they want to go to bed later. And this is a well-researched phenomenon. This isn't just, you know, this isn't in the way somewhere, it's well known that actually the circadian rhythm shifts and kids will start to go to bed later. So they might start wanting to go to sleep at 11 o'clock, which means to get their 8 hours, they probably need to sleep, they get up at 7. And yet, the system that's in place for these kids is actually telling them, no, they're going to get up at 4:30. And then we know that they don't really make that sleep up. you know, and sleep deprivation can have some really, really negative effects to the cognitive, social, psychological function. You know, it can be as bad as like as getting drunk, you know, in terms of the effect that they can have. So that is one of the things where you go, well, actually, if you're going to build a youth sport program, you need to start taking into account some of that research that's going to help. Because you might be going, why is this kid all over the place? He's not engaged, he's not switched on. It's like, well, yeah, because he actually hasn't been catching up on his sleep, so he hasn't had enough sleep over the week. Because he's getting up at 4:30 to get to a 6 a.m. gym session. So there's
That's a really interesting one. I've heard a similar kind of theme come out of a strength and conditioning coach who's quite well known in the States, basically saying, like, don't preach to your athletes about recovery when you make them come in the gym at 6 a.m.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, because the number one thing with recovery is sleep, and you've just deprived them of it. You know, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Yeah. And I come in, you have people challenge it and kind of go, well, what are you saying that we should never do early sessions? And I'm saying, well, no, that's not what we're saying. It's just like, hey, you got to take into account, and you got to realize then that you can't get angry if you're going to do it, which I would recommend don't do it. But if you are, you can't get angry if they're not quite there, switched on, because what you're doing to them is going to be causing that as well. So you need to take that into account. And so that's across the board with a whole lot of other aspects of the youth sport things. And that includes the way you coach and the way you engage and connect with your players. But, you know, I'm a big believer in taking a humanistic approach. You got to put the human first. And so that, and at that age group, that's how you, if you show them that you care, then you'll get their buy-in and they'll kind of run through a brick wall for you. But until you do that, you know, they're pretty perceptive kids, so they'll pick up pretty quickly if you're not authentic and you're not real and you don't really care about them, and that'll impact your ability to connect with them as well.
So I know we kind of mentioned off air, but a couple of resources that you might recommend to people who are coaching young athletes that are a bit more interested in this area. I know there's a couple of books that you were kind of thinking about.
Yeah. So it's quite interesting. A couple of books that I read that kind of really helped shape, I guess, where like my head was at around this professionalisation in the sport, because I'd heard a lot. I mean, in New Zealand, you get a lot from football over there as well. I mean, they do stuff, and I remember hearing a bit around how you should model yourself on the English football system. You know, they're doing all this amazing stuff with all these kids. And there are two books. One of them's called Every Boy's Dream, which is by Chris Green. And that was released in 2009. And then there's a second one, which is called No Hunger in Paradise by Michael Calvin. And that was released in 2017. And that's actually really good to read, kind of Every Boy's Dream, then No Hunger in Paradise, because they're about 8 years apart, because one was looking in 2009, one was 2017. And they show that they really get highlighted some of the issues with the English football development system and some of the really scary things that are happening. Some of the academy system, you know, where academies were pumping a whole lot of resource into stuff and not getting one senior, you know, in 10 years, they didn't get one senior football player out of it, you know, and they're selling the dream to these kids. And then these kids that from 5 years old, you know, they can be traded, you know, for money. These kids are being told you're going to be a superstar, and then at 16, they just get cut and these kids have got nothing for them. And it was a real eye-opening experience for me to read that and going, is this where New Zealand's heading? And is that actually where we want to go? And so with that professionalisation coming, seeping down, and I'm seeing it in, you know, we saw it in rugby, it's starting to go down and down, and it's kind of going, it's a bit scary because these kids are going, well, you know, I need to be in this under 13 rep team, because if I'm not in this system, I don't have a chance to make it. And you're like, that's ridiculous. You haven't even started developing yet. You know, and then you hear, one of the things, you hear the way that the scouts and things would talk about these kids, you know, it sort of dehumanizes them. And some of the language you hear, like even in our system, you often hear players referred to as cattle. You know, oh, we didn't quite have the cattle for the game. You know, our cattle aren't that good. And you kind of go, well, now you're just dehumanizing them anyway. And so this is kind of the language we use and the way we do it is starting to shape that way. So I kind of, but some of those are just great, great books to read, to go, if you're working in the youth sports system, because we build this system, like if we've got a role in the system, we can change the system. Like I just remember with Auckland Rugby, we did some work around our under 13 space when I was there. We sort of moved away from the selection based tournament to actually having an open development system so kids could opt in. Because we know at 13 it's a bit ridiculous because of all the maturation differences, we had a massive relative age effect all this stuff. So we looked at our system and people go, no, it's all right. And what we had is that we had one kid who didn't get selected from the previous year, and he lived next door to one of the people I worked with. And so she had asked him how was his experience of not being selected. And it was his second year of trying to make the team. He didn't make it. And what we found out was that he actually stopped playing rugby after he didn't make the team because he was so gutted about not playing and not making it. Because he said he did everything that the coaches wanted to. He was a hooker. He said, I did all the things they wanted, but they obviously wanted something else. They didn't really tell me. So we were like, oh, wow. And we were like, oh, but he's playing now. What happened? And his parents were like, yeah. So we didn't realise actually how upset he was. And he stopped playing. So about 4 weeks, he didn't play. But then he was at school and he had an interview. They had speech competition in the school. And one of the kids in the school gave a speech about how Richie McCaw wasn't the best under 13 rugby player in his age group and didn't make his rep side. But he's turned out to be the greatest All Black of all time. And the kid got it and was like, okay, I can go play rugby. And so someone who is helping to try and build the system, I go, oh my God, our system doesn't work. You know, our system is based on whether these kids will stay in the game on hope and serendipity. We hope that they'll come back. And that's not a great system to have. You know, and you get pushed back and you go, well, when do you have to bring selection in and all that stuff? And you go, you know, you get people saying, oh, you're mollycoddling these kids. If you don't have selection, the world's harsh and da da da. I go, so, well, sport doesn't have to be harsh. And also, if we want to build resilience, we can build them in other ways. We know that two key factors in resilience are psychological flexibility and social support. Does our system provide that? No. We're just hoping that he'll hear some other kid tell a speech about Richie McCaw and he'll stay in the game. So that's kind of one of those things where it's like, well, yeah, we have a role to play in the system to make sure that we're providing the best possible experience to these kids, but also helping them to be successful. That kid could go out. He's only 13. He could go on and be a great All Black. No one knows. But he might, if he gets shunted out of the system, or like me, turns up and the coach says, oh, you have to train both days. So he says, oh, okay, thanks. No thanks. Well, he didn't have a chance to do it.
Mm. Yeah, that's a conversation I've had. Look, my previous boss, Mark Robertson, is a silver medalist at the Rio Olympics in sevens. He didn't play any age grade rugby for Scotland. Over 100 tests. Yeah. So, you know, I had that player, that discussion with a player recently where he said, oh, you know, if I don't get this academy contract, you know, will I still be able to make a professional? I'm like, mate, there's many roads to Rome. Like, you know, that's not, it's not just a linear route and people go away to New Zealand and play a few seasons, come back and decide, you know, someone takes a punt on them. There's players at the moment from Scotland who are playing in New Zealand, playing for Waikato and, you know, their route wasn't here. It took them somewhere else. Like, there's just, you know, if you love the game and you'll find a way if you're good enough, you know. No, that's what happens, but it doesn't mean you have to go through this system in this exact way.
Yeah, exactly. And the problem that we have is that kind of the system's kind of perpetuating the myth of that that's actually what has to happen. And then people believe it and then they give up. And people go, oh, well, you know, they shouldn't give up. They need to be more resilient. It's like, well, the system doesn't allow them to do that, you know, because it's not providing them that support that they need. You know, and also by 13 and having selection based things, you're actually telling something. We might say, oh, it doesn't matter, yet we're telling them something different. And so we have to change that system up to allow for, well, actually all these kids need to have the ability to get some of that development at whatever level they're at. Because you never know what happens when they're 16 and they have their growth spurt and they grow 8 inches and suddenly they're gonna be a lock.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you today with you, Sam. I really enjoyed it and a lot of real useful information for people to consider and reflect on. Where can people find out more about you and about your work and what you're doing?
Yeah. So, look, you don't actually have a lot going on at the moment. I don't really have much of a presence online other than your kind of general personal stuff. Certainly LinkedIn, they can get in contact with me through there. It makes me sound really old, actually, when I say that. Like, LinkedIn, yeah, great. So, I mean, I'm definitely getting old. But certainly through LinkedIn, you can do that. And I'm hoping that over the next little bit, well, I've got a little bit of time as well, I'll start putting together some stuff around my research, and certainly through like the Balance is Better page through Sport New Zealand, they've got hopefully get a bit of stuff around my research up on that as well, so I can see that there. So hopefully sort of been doing a few of these things, and thanks very much for giving me the time to chat. It's always awesome and create new connections and with people overseas, so I really love that and certainly learn a lot from talking to talking to people. So yeah, mainly through LinkedIn if they want to get in touch with me, and happy to discuss, always happy to discuss my research as well.
Awesome, mate. Well, thanks again so much for your time. It's been a real pleasure. I really appreciate it.
No, thanks very much, Rob. Loved it. How do you know, man?